Hey everybody, welcome back to We Are Movies. As always, I'm Johnny Mockney, and my guest today is Diana Graham. Diana is a comedian from Detroit, a very funny and original comedian too, with one of, I think, one of the most fascinating and interesting stage presences out of a lot of the comics that I know. They've always had this ability to sort of weave in and out of being very silly and very vulnerable in a way that it works, and I'm just so happy that we finally got this to happen. We've talked for a while about doing this episode, and we finally are. Diana decided to come on and talk about The Big Sick, which is one of the great movies about comedians, if you've never heard of it. It's a more recent 2017 movie. If you're a fan of Kumail Nanjiani, I don't know how you haven't seen it. But if you're a fan of his, you're a fan of stand-up comedy, if you like a great rom-com, if you want a beautiful true story, you should see this movie yesterday, honestly. And then after you see it, you should come back here and enjoy this episode. So without any further ado, here is me and Diana Graham talking about The Big Sick. People sometimes bring notes. I never tell people to, but whenever somebody does have notes, it's always a relief. Because like some people just go off the dome. Sometimes, like if I'm recording with like Zach Bricar or something, he's not prepared at all. But then like I'll have somebody come on and it's like this is their favorite movie of all time, and they need to make sure they say everything about it. Do you consider this your favorite movie of all time, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually didn't have a favorite movie until I saw this movie. I used to be like, oh, I don't know. And then I saw this movie and I'm like, this is actually, now I have a favorite movie. I'm just like everybody else.
Okay, perfect. Did you consider yourself a movie person at all before or not really?
I like movies. If it was between being a movie person and a TV person, I would say I'm more a TV person.
Okay.
But I was not allowed to consume media until I was like 13.
Really?
So like I haven't seen a lot of stuff, and then the only reason I was able to start like watching movies and TV shows is because I had Netflix on my 3DS, and I'm not like in my parent, it was my brother's account. I have a brother that's like 10 years older than me, so like my parents weren't allowed to control that basically.
Yeah, when you say no media, that even like kids stuff you never watched growing up?
We had PBS, but we didn't have like cable, so like yeah, I could watch Cyber Chase.
Oh, sure, yeah. Cyber Chase was great, yeah.
Between the Lions, that sort of stuff. But yeah, like, you could list movies, and most of them I probably haven't seen, that sort of stuff, but
I remember when Gilbert Gottfried passed, I was, like, the only person going, like, yeah, I knew him from Cyber Chase. That was my, like...
No! You know,
everyone else was talking about, like, Aladdin and shit, but I was I was still on Cyber Chase. I guess that kind of begs the question then, when since it took a while before you really, like, started consuming media and, I guess, like, Netflix, what was the lead into trying stand-up then? Had you already watched stand-up comedy and gotten into it as a fan first, or?
Stand-up comedy I got into because same kind of situation, my other brother, I was on his Pandora account. And so, because like I wasn't allowed to have an email, so his Pandora account, he had a station that he had made himself of like stand-up comedy. And I started listening to it and I was like, what is this? I didn't know it existed. I didn't know that was a thing people did. And so at like 12, I start listening to stand-up and I'm like, oh, what is this?
Yeah. It's fascinating. Like, I guess that's funny because I feel like sometimes there's this opposite sort of trajectory we go in where we grow up, like I grew up knowing what stand-up is and I kind of take it for granted. And then once you get into it and you start doing it, you're like, that's insane that this is an art form. Like this is like it's kind of the weirdest art form that exists. So to discover it at 12 and already be familiar with what art is supposed to be and going like, wait, you can do this? This is a job?
No, I was literally like mind blown. Like just like the sheer idea that there were people who recorded albums of them talking. Like, I was like, literally, what is going on? Like, what is this audience? Like, I couldn't fathom any of it. I was like, is this some sort of TV show that they recorded? Like, what's happening? But yeah, I think ever since I started, like, I was listening to it. And then, like, I think too, it's just like synapse formed in my brain where I was like, I will simply do this one day. I love this so much. And never did I think it was going to be in the capacity of which I've been able to do it in this century. You know, like, I just the idea of getting to go on a stage and do it somewhere was my biggest dream. Like, I thought no further than that. I didn't know anything else existed. Just like the idea of, you know, an open mic was an insane thing to me. So I look back at that 12-year-old and I thank them very much. And I try to get perspective on that when I'm like frustrated if I don't get into a festival or something, because I should be happy with where I'm at.
Right. Yeah. When you think about from, you know, 12-year-old you would probably just be amazed, you know.
Yeah, shitting themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. Who were some of the people that you listened to at the time that caught your attention?
The like very first stand-up comedians I like knew by name were Dan Cummins, John Mulaney, and I want to say like Daniel Tosh or something.
Oh, okay.
Like that, the Pandora station is just like today's comedians. Like, it's just like the best comedians of, you know, so that would have been like 2011. So yeah, Dan Cummins was like the first one. I was more into Dan Cummins than any of them. And I got to go see and be at the recording of his most recent album.
Oh, wow.
I think, I don't think he's come out with another one yet. It was in like 2019. I think.
Okay.
And that was super cool because it was a special and an album. So he did his most famous bit, which is like the first thing of his that I ever like literally memorized. And he had never done a video recording of it. So he did it that day because he's never like recorded a special before. And Eric Laux could tell you, I lost my mind. I was like, oh my God, he's doing it. He's doing the story.
It's interesting how like, to comedy fans, a comic doing a bit that you love is like a band doing a song that you love. Like, I remember
I was just hitting him. I was hitting Eric. I was like, oh my, I know this.
Yeah. That's so cool. I remember when I saw Jim Gaffigan at DTE and it was like an all new hour, but then at the end of it, he started doing the Hot Pockets bit. And it's when it clicked with me, I was like, oh, this is like Lynyrd Skynyrd doing Freebird or something. Like, cause the audience, like just when he mentioned Hot Pockets, they started cheering. Like he hadn't even told a joke yet, but like, they were like, oh, it's coming. You know?
It's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you then consider, I mean, cause a lot of people, we know so many comics, and I think a lot of people have that, like there's a spectrum of how much comedy takes over their life, like whether or not they're a comic first or if they're like a lawyer first, comic second or something,
like a human being.
yeah exactly. do you consider yourself a comic first above all?
No
That's healthy. That's very healthy, actually.
I think there was a time where it was everything to me, and unfortunately, well, for better or for worse, it's had to not be anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
So
when did you see The Big Sick for the first time?
When it came out in theaters. So okay. That was me too. 2017, and I went to it was a theater in like the neighboring city in Westland. And they had, it was called, I don't know if you remember this, but it was The Bigger Sick. So it's this like promotional kind of like, it was basically like they included the bonus features in the theater.
Okay.
So like it was The Big Sick, but it was like a little bit longer. And so you got to, if you stayed seated, they had like interviews and stuff that they had done, like talking more about the fact like that it was a true story and just like talking more about that and like the writing process for them and that sort of thing. So yeah, it was really cool.
That's cool. I so in 2017 you hadn't started doing comedy yet, right?
I did stand-up comedy for the first time in 2016.
I
did it like maybe three or four times within the course of like from 2016 to like 2018. And then like 2018 and 2019 is when I like actually started doing it on the regular, and I would say like that was actually a comedian at that point.
Okay, cool.
Because I was 16 years old.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I always joke about like when I started doing open mics, like I was 18, and they made me like buy a salad at Crunchy's because you had to be 21 and up. So like they were like, all right, you have to buy food and you have to leave after you're done. Like I had to like strike a deal with them. It's hard to be young.
I got kicked out. I've gotten kicked out of a show before because they were like, I didn't know you were that young.
Oh wow.
Like when I was like 19.
I've met some like there's this like 14-year-old who performed at the garage show at the salsa parlor one time, and she was at the top of the show because her parents wanted her to leave before anybody else went up.
Obviously.
Understandably. and she was good, and I just kept thinking, I was like, man, that would imagine me like 14 and like there's nothing for you to do. There's like, you know, every single show is at 9 p.m. in a bar.
Yeah, and like I talked to Brad Winslow and I, like the first time that we ever really met, like we bonded over the fact that we both kind of started or tried to start when you were like 17. Mm-hmm. And just the like finding these like bizarro like open media, like mixed media open mics, and then yeah, like, you know, and then just being in bars that young and everybody being like, oh, the kid is here, you know.
right having to like go to like coffee shop open mics that are mostly just acoustic guitar covers, and you're like the one person doing stand-up because that's your only talent. Like I definitely did that.
the first time I ever did stand-up, which I was freshly 17, it was like a week after my birthday, and I went to this mixed open mic, and I looked on the list and everybody else was like poetry. It, yeah, you know, music, whatever, and I literally like was freaking out. I was such an anxious kid, and I was like, is it okay if I do stand-up? And they're like, yeah, no, it's okay, we've never had anybody do this before. Like, oh no.
Did you do well? Do you feel like, because I feel like sometimes if you're the only comic on like a talent show lineup, people like it a bit more because they're surprised by it. I don't know.
Yes, I've done, like after my first time, I've since then done like coffee open mics like that where I tell them I'm doing spoken word. And I've killed, because I don't think people like poetry. I don't think anybody actually likes listening to that. And no. So by the end of the night, like they're really grateful to hear some puns.
Right.
So those are really fun shows. I'd say a lot of the times it's really fun. But did I do well that night? No. I had like a couple of good laughs maybe, but it's a pretty cringy set. I will say though, the next time, like the first time I ever did stand up in like actual comedy club, so I was like 18, that's when like Robert Schneider met me. Mm. And we talked about it like years later on his podcast, and he was like, wait, that was like your first club mic? And I was like, yeah. He's like, but you were good already. And I was like, well, I had 2 years of like random mic to get all the.
Yeah. I was cutting my teeth at coffee shops for a little while.
Exactly. Like just like doing the cringiest, like the worst shit that all the open micers do. I got that off the way already. So
that's great. Yeah. No, it's very lucky to do that. Whereas a lot of people start going to the clubs and they still have that 2 years worth of stuff that they need to, to shake off.
Like the making fun of the audience. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
There's always, I always get excited when it's like a young guy and it's his first time, because I think there's like this, I don't want to say it's like a Schadenfreude, but there's definitely like a joy I get from the tension in the room when a first timer is bombing. Like I haven't quite figured that out about myself, but
I look forward to a part of him breaking. You know what I mean?
Yes. Just seeing like one of two things going to happen. This is going to be the beginning of the rest of his life. And he's going to like, and he's going to go, oh, I'm not as good as I thought I was. I really got to try harder. Or he's going to go, not for me, never again. And leave.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I remember I did school talent shows my junior and senior year of high school. And I was like, combined, I did a lot of time, I remember. It's insane. But combined from doing those two sets, I was like, oh, I've got 30 minutes of solid material. I'm the best comedian ever. And then I did Max for the first time. And I was like, oh, I got like 2 minutes of like solid material. So it's humbling, really.
Yeah, for sure.
By the time you watched The Big Sick, then, was a big appeal of the movie the fact that it was about comedians?
Yeah, well, I was just like, I was obsessed with comedy, you know, like just obsessed with stand-up comedians, like obsessed with like hearing about their lives and everything. So this was like a culmination of that. And I loved Kumail Nanjiani. So like, I love his album. It's one of the only comedy albums I have, like in entirety on iTunes. So like, I mean, in the theater, I freaked out because he was doing the jokes from his album that I love so much because it was set in like the same time period or whatever. So it was really cool.
It's I remember when the movie came out, he because now he's a pretty mainstream star, like he's in Marvel movies and stuff now.
Yeah.
When the movie came out, I think he was still like he was a popular stand-up, but he wasn't a movie star or anything.
No, and he wasn't even really an actor. Like he was, but like
Right. I
not
think
on that level. And I do think it's accredited to the success of The Big Sick that people started looking at him for those kind of roles.
definitely. And I mean it's pretty bold too that it's autobiographical. He's playing himself. And it's just not oftentimes you get an autobiographical movie about somebody who's not that famous. Like that's it's pretty rare.
It's that cool of a story.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, definitely when I first saw it, like a lot of the appeal was like you know, I'm like 50-50 on rom-coms in general. I'm like I don't have any strong feelings about them, but we'll get to the romance story because I obviously I do think it's great, but I was just like so enthralled with the scenes of comedians sitting around and like one of my favorite lines when I was rewatching it the other day is just a, it's very like it's almost like it's like off camera they're just shooting the shit and they're like throwing ideas and like the last line of the scene is a guy goes I got a Taco Bell one and it like cuts to the next scene and it's even funnier considering that I know 70 comedians with a Taco Bell bit. Like, you know, like.
No, like I was when I was rewatching it, I was like, this is so real. Like the when what are they the Sam guy?
Oh, yeah, people say Sam.
People say Sam. And when he's coming off stage and then they're talking, him and Bo are talking and they're like, I'm gonna tell him. He's a hack. I'm gonna tell him, I'm gonna tell him. Great set, man. Great. Love the new stuff.
That's no, yeah, that's one of the best parts too. That whole like saying great set to somebody you don't respect. Like,
I was like, wow, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, and the way that he casts all of the comedian friends with real comics, like Bo Burnham and A.D. Bryant, and all of them. David Alan Greer is the MC at the show,
Yeah.
like, you know.
No, that's actually my first like note that I made when when I was rewatching and I just wrote down any like thoughts I had and like the first note I made was like what a cool role that he gave to Bo Burnham, like because Bo Burnham has never gotten to be that guy, you know, like Bo Burnham has always done musical comedy and he gave Bo a role where he could write. I'm sure Bo wrote his own shit, you know, that he could write just like regular stand-up comedy material and then just like get to play a regular stand-up comedian because Bo Burnham's been famous since he was 18, you know, like he didn't come up in that normal way.
Well, yeah, he came up in an unconventional way through the internet first before
Yeah.
live performances too. And did you ever see his interview on The Green Room with Paul Provenza, where he it was like an old show where Paul Provenza would get a bunch of comics together, and he in an early episode, Bo Burnham was there, and also, funny enough, Ray Romano was there too, who's also in this movie. Yeah, but that's the thing he mentions. He's like, yeah, people said to me like, oh, you never like hit the pavement and like went to the clubs, you didn't come up that way, so you know how harsh it is. And he's like, I don't know what's harsher than a YouTube comment. Like the comment sections are worse than anything someone can say to me at a club.
Yeah,
Yeah.
people say a
Atrocious things.
lot worse things on the internet than they
Yeah.
nobody comes up to you after a show and says that horrible of shit.
Right.
Like people say that on the internet.
Yeah,
So
definitely. And but yeah, I like the bit of material he's given where he's like I like they're all kind of different types of comics. Like Bo is a stool sitting kind of long-winded comic, and I like he the bit we hear about him like to talking about the universe and everything, and it's just about him forgetting his girlfriend's birthday.
Yeah.
And then A.D. Bryant has like the pictures, the props. Yeah. And then the one who I have a lot of respect for is Kurt Braunohler, because he's playing a bad comedian. Like, that's very bold. So like,
but
like,
it also, like, I like that they have the hack Sam. Yeah. People say Sam. They have him, and like, how everybody's nice to him, but like, it's like, oh. But they, and then they have this other comedian who's, you know, he's playing a bad comedian, but like, everybody loves him. Like, they're still like friends. Like, he's the guy's roommate, and you know, and like, that is very real in comedy, because there are people that are just staples of the community, and it doesn't matter if that's as far as they're gonna go. Right. Everybody still loves him.
Yeah, he's not gonna make the move out to New York, but we like his company, you know, while he's there. And and there, genuinely, like, it's like, there are people that, like, maybe nobody loves their material, but they're a pleasant enough presence that nobody has a problem with them. You know?
Exactly. It's just, it's such a perfect, and obviously it is because he is a stand-up comedian, but it is just like a perfect look into stand-up community. Like,
yeah, definitely. Oh, one of my other like side favorite lines is when he's pitching the joke about where he's like, I saw a dog at an airport with an erection, and I thought, does that mean bombs or drugs? And Bo Burnham's like, oh, that's good. Except, how about instead of it being an airport, you quit comedy and never do comedy
again? Never do comedy again.
Yeah. Very, very close to like the types of things we would say to each other, like writing. And that was something, I guess when I saw this in theaters, I had just started too. And so what I liked about the movie was like, I liked stand-up comedy and I was doing it, but I had not yet felt like I was part of a community like that.
Yes.
Right? Like, you had that circle. And so there was something really satisfying, you looking at the circle of friends like, oh, I want that.
Yes. Yeah. You just like, you want to be part of it so bad. And like, that's the huge component of it is the community and the culture of it. And having like written jokes and then performed jokes at that point, but not truly be like, felt like a comedian, like in it.
Right.
Yeah. I ate it up. Like, I just loved every scene like that.
So how familiar were you with the fact that this was a true story when you watched it? Did you know that when you first saw it, or?
I think I did. I think it was in like the promotional stuff that it was like him and his wife. One of the parts that I freaked out about though was that not only he was like doing the same material, but if you, I don't know how well you know his album, but like in his album, the heckle that Emily heckles him at is in his album. He truly gets that heckle on his album.
Yeah.
And so I freaked out because I was like, oh my God, is she on the album? Like,
right. Is that her?
Like, yeah. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. And like later I was like, no, it's probably not. But I really loved that they like completely, you know, replicated a real heckle that he's gotten before.
Yeah, definitely. It's a cool, like, if you're a fan of his, like, it totally works if you don't know who Camille Nanjiani is at all. Like, it works independently as a movie. But then, yeah, if you're a fan, like, there's all those little things too that you can find. Co-wrote it with his wife, Emily V. Gordon. So there's already like the spoiler that, you know, she's going to survive. Since, you know,
well, thank God I wouldn't have watched it.
Right. Yeah.
I only do comedies. I don't do sad shit. So.
Right. Yeah. So that being said, like, what do you think about like the way the movie balances those things, that like, cause it's not just funny because it's about comics. There are jokes in the movie. Like, there are a lot of parts that make me laugh really hard.
Yeah.
One of my favorite jokes is when the doctors are talking to him and Emily's parents and they're in the bereavement room and it's just...
Don't read anything into that.
Right. This is just the only room we had available. Like, that's a great joke. But then, the emotion's like there. Like, I don't know if I choked up when I saw it, but I definitely like, particularly like the big dramatic moment where he goes on stage and bombs because he's... You know, and he's just honest, like, you feel that.
Oh my God, yeah. Oh, I don't think I cried in the theater, but now that when I rewatch it, I sob like almost every time.
Yeah.
Like, it's just that huge moment. And I have written down in my notes that I relate so much to him breaking down at the Burger King And then also having a breakdown at like a comedy show like that, I was like, wow, me and Kumail, like now that I'm like watching it now as like somebody who's been doing stand up for a few years now, I'm like, yeah, I felt that. Yeah. Felt that heavy.
Yeah. I think the movie does a really good job at like, it never makes any of the scenes feel tedious. Like, it is sort of that sort of flabby, like it's produced by Judd Apatow. And so I can see like some of his fingerprints in terms of like that. There's like long scenes of people like riffing and stuff like that, but it feels very efficient. Every scene ends like, it never feels like it outstays its welcome. It's like, like that scene where he freaks out at the Burger King, it ends like perfectly on like just the right joke. It doesn't go too long. It feels like efficient. Like I think it's much more like well edited than I think a lot of the sort of flabbier dramedies that we tend to have are, you know? Mm-hmm. So how many times do you think you've watched it since you first saw it?
Probably not more than 10.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
But on like, probably not that far from 10.
Sure, yeah. One thing that I also that I think kind of blew me away the first time I watched it was like, so Ray Romano and Holly Hunter are the parents, and they're, I think, incredible. Like, they're both really, like, Holly Hunter's really good, especially like in the scene when he gets the heckler saying go back to ISIS, and then the way that she attacks that guy is so great. But then like, for Ray Romano, like a guy who is a comedian and a comedic actor, he's so funny, but like so downbeat, like almost besides like one scene, he plays the part so realistically. And I would like laugh till I wheezed a couple times, like when he tries to tell like the joke about the giraffe at the bar, or when he's asking if he knows parlor games and it's like the can you name it
bit.
It's just every like, it's such a subtle performance, but everything feels so calculated in terms of how funny it is. Did you know Ray Romano at all before you saw the movie, or?
Yeah, like I recognized him, but I wouldn't be able to say anything about, you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right. We know the voice from Ice Age, at least, I'm sure.
But sure, I've seen Ice Age.
I guess if you didn't consume media until 13, you missed the Ice Age window. Like when you would have seen it.
Yeah.
So let's go to your notes. I want to make sure we're hitting the things that you wanted to mention. What are things that stuck out to you rewatching it again, or things that, like, I don't know, like, I guess starting where you think is the best place to start, what do you have?
So it was a bit more on the heckle scene, or like, well, when Emily heckles him, I love the heckle discussion that he has.
Yeah.
Like, you know, actually anything, like interrupting with anything is a heckle. Yeah. Because it's like a conversation I've had with my friends since then. And I've been like, no, anything you say during a comedy show is heckling. It doesn't actually matter if it's good.
The way he goes, it's a common misconception.
Like, yeah, yeah.
When he was explaining it, yeah.
So I love that. I definitely use that. Also, like the scene, so she heckles and then he comes up to her at the bar, you know, and where he writes the like her name in Urdu. Mm-hmm. I know this from watching The Bigger Sick and like interviews and stuff. So that was like a real thing that he did, like to girls in bars. And Emily said in the interview, she's like, oh, I actually did fall for it. Like we had movie Emily not, and she was like, no, I swooned. Like,
yeah.
She's like, I ate it up.
I like the reveal that, because it happens with another girl after he breaks up with Emily early, in the first act, and that's when it like clicks with me. I'm like, oh, that's his routine, that's what he does. That's funny that they wrote it differently, and it like he has to try a little bit harder. But that's kind of like in the context of the movie, you see that's what separates her from the other girls.
Yeah, because they had to do it in some like in some symbolism, some way to like,
yeah,
show that kind of dynamic with them. And then also like, I feel like you kind of mentioned this, but just like the lack of cringe, it being a rom-com, and the lack of cringiness, like there was no like, and now they're together, like No, it was so like real and like, you know, intense at moments when it needed to be, but like even in the really intense moments, like the scene at the Burger King, like the reason I relate to that so much is because like you he still pulls back because he's like, I should not have done that. Let me clean up the trash, you know,
He realizes it's just like some pimple-faced kid and it's his first day, like
who's this wee man? It's me and you. Like, no, like I just, it's so like, yeah, it's just there's no cringe because it is just so real. Like it's not like facade of what people are like.
Yeah, even like the montage of their relationship going by and like what a good time they're having. There's totally like a cringy version of that that could have happened, like them like, you know, walking down parks and laughing and then getting ice cream, accidentally getting ice cream on their noses or something. Like, but it's just like them sitting on the couch and he's like trying to read a book and she's kicking him, like stuff like that. Very real. Yeah. But like, and that's like sitting on a couch with somebody and not talking to them is a level of intimacy that few young relationships even make it to. Like, and that's one thing I really love is like the way it kind of really encapsulates specifically like modern dating and like how modern relationships happen. Like, I love how when he takes her home after meeting her in the club, there's that like, we got to rush by my roommate because he's going to talk to us. And they got to like run right into the room. And then also the way that like in modern dating, there's always like that, just like that period of like not quite knowing what you're doing together, like what this is. And there's like her resistance to dating him. And like basically just having sex with him, but then like they can't, like then they have feelings for each other. Like that's something that like I don't think you couldn't put that in a rom-com 30 years ago because
No,
it wouldn't have clicked.
she would have dropped out of college. You know what I mean?
Right,
Like, maybe like, oh, I'm getting married now. I mean,
No reason for this education.
literally.
I'm here to support a man's career.
In stand-up comedy.
Right. His future in stand-up comedy.
That's like, and I feel like it goes back to like just how real. Like they portray stand-up comedians, but I love when he's hanging out with the parents and he's trying to ditch them and he's like, I'm actually gigging tonight. And he's like trying to say, like, I'm gigging. And like, cause like, oh, like we've all, I feel like we've all done it, like trying to flex to people that, you know, don't really care, don't really know, or like whatever, trying to be like, oh, I'm headlining, or you know what,
I
like
I like
that
I'll
just.
say it's like, oh, I've got a show like in another city, but it really means I'm gonna be spending gas money to lose money, maybe break even, do 7 minutes in a bar somewhere. Like, but we're underplaying that. We're just like, oh yeah, I got a show. Like
My show tonight, and it's like your show, you're on with 10 other comedians doing 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Like,
Right.
I love it. I love the him trying to flex because I'm like, that's so real. I've done that.
It's to be like we've all done that. I still do it, you know. I'll like, because I need my grandpa to think I'm actually doing something worthy of my time. I can't tell him I'll drive all the way to New Way Bar to go up at 1 a.m.
He doesn't need to know
He doesn't,
that.
yeah, no. But yeah, I do love that. And then they still go to
Doesn't work. Well, you're the headliner. You can get us in. He's like,
right. He's like, yeah, I can.
he does a guest set. Like, oh, so funny.
I think that's, I mean, his I feel like playing yourself is probably one of the hardest things to do as an actor, but there's just something so seamless about how Kumail does it. Like he and I don't know how much, to what extent he's like recreating these actual emotions that he felt, or how much of him is it him like kind of rewriting, because I feel like making a movie about events in your life, you're like given the opportunity to rewrite it the way you want it to be and not the way it was. And I'm sure there's a marriage of those two things in the movie.
Like I like that, you know, he's an asshole sometimes. Like he's the main character in the movie, and like sometimes it's like you're real, like in their fight scene where he's like, well, you were fucking hiding something too. And then she was like, that does not mean our future is impossible. Like, you're in the wrong here. Like,
yes,
that doesn't actually change anything. What you're doing does change things. Like,
it's that I love that argument scene too, because one of the reasons so many rom-coms are bad, I think, is that they fail to find a realistic conflict between people. Usually, like, when the characters break up, it's like there was a misunderstanding or something. Like, we can't.
Yeah, something like really annoying, like, oh, we miscommunicated. I'm not at the mall. I'm at the, you know,
stupid. You heard me saying something mean and you thought it was about you, but it was really about this other person.
I was on the phone. Like,
right.
Something stupid.
And it's like, I think that's just lazy storytelling, because it's like you need to. It's somewhat difficult to write likably flawed people, you know, which is what most people are. And so it's like, what's great about that argument scene is, you know, she's correct. Like, she's right. You understand she has every right to be walking out at this point, realizing that they don't really have a possible future together. So it seems that his parents don't even know about her. And then also I understand him, because like, I understand why he's been holding back on saying something for so long, because he doesn't want it to end, even though it's mm-hmm. like at the back of his mind. And so it's like a perfect dynamic for like a good argument scene.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Allison.
We've both been guests on We Are Movies before.
We love talking movies with Johnny.
But I'm a jealous boy.
You are. That's why we've decided to talk movies with each other.
We started our own podcast called
You Made Me Watch. Each week we make each other watch a movie the other has never seen.
You Made Me Watch.
New episodes every Friday.
But I was going to say about Ray Romano's character and the scene where he sleeps over at Kamau's house.
Yeah.
And just the line of like that, like, you know, already awkward tension, like he doesn't really want to be sleeping in the same room as Ray, like, or let alone same apartment or something. And like, he's trying to just like be there for him. And then they set up the other air mattress and they're laying there and Kamau's like, okay, good night. And then he just goes, I cheated on her. And then Kamau goes, fuck.
Right. Yeah, knowing that, oh, this is where the heart-to-heart's gonna happen.
Like, oh god. And then just like his other line that I love is like the one where he's like, that's why it sucks, that's why they call it love. And Kamau's like, I'm not sure I'm following that one either. And he's like, I just thought if I kept talking I'd say something smart,
something would come out. Yeah. I love that scene a lot too, because they never totally vibe in the scene. Like, it's realistic in that Kumail's uncomfortable the whole time.
And
even though it's important for the development of these characters that Ray Romano gets this out, it's still clear at the end of it Kumail's like, he probably still would have preferred not to have had that conversation.
Yeah, it's like a stepping stone, not just like, we've had this one scene and now they're best buds. Like,
right.
Just, no, again, keeping with the realism of it all.
I mean, I love in general, like, how when the movie ends, everything isn't totally resolved. It's just that we know we're on a way towards things being better resolved. Particularly with Kumail's parents. And we haven't talked about his family yet in the movie, but I love the portrayal of his family. Like, I love that, like, especially the, like, we understand how he doesn't fit into his own culture, how he doesn't pray and things like that, but then also that he does have a genuine bond, like, with his brother. And then as the movie progresses, we start to see the beginning of him, like, finally kind of bonding with his parents. And that's like a thing that I love too. It's very hard to kind of like fit all those things into one movie, but there's that tension with his parents that I think is realistic, where it's like there's this clear ideological conflict, but he still loves his family. That's still apparent.
I mean, the scene where he comes in for dinner, like, knowing they're not going to talk to him.
Yeah.
And just like lays it out. And he's like, I'm part of your family, whether you like it or not. Like, I don't care if it's not real, but like that's not what he really did. But just like, incredible. Like, just like, I don't know your family situation is, but like, rewatching it, that's literally my next bullet point, was just like the honesty of having these parents that give conditional love. And like, to like, that's what hit harder when I watched it this time, is just like, because I've been considering lately the idea of letting my parents in on who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And just like, it's way too scary. And so it's like I can maintain this good relationship with my parents, but in the back of your mind, like, there's always the, like, if they knew, like, we wouldn't have it anymore. Right. And so, like, to watch somebody, like, he's like that at the beginning, like, he's where I'm at the beginning, like, he is dating this white girl, and, like, you know, and he's doing stand-up, but they don't like, but they think he's also studying law, and, like, you know, to play all those dynamics, and then him at the end of the day being, like, you can't kick me out. I'm your family, whether you like it or not. Like, I cried. Like,
yeah. No, that is really moving. I mean, is that something that you related to when you first saw it, or is that something that over time you've kind of grown to?
It definitely, yeah. It was definitely the more recent watches of it that really hit home, because, like, when I was a teenager, you know, there's a lot of things I didn't know about myself yet.
Sure.
And yeah, it's way more real to me, like, way, way more relatable now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a thing that I think, like, the best autobiographical stories are the ones where someone can take this very specific circumstance in their life, but posit it in a way where you're like, this is applicable in so many ways and so many things. Like, this isn't just a movie about being part of a Muslim American family. Like, this is it's not just about a Pakistani family. Like, it's about being different from your family in any way, and mm-hmm. wanting to be specifically having these dreams and these ambitions. And you can kind of draw this line between him wanting to do stand-up comedy and also wanting to be with this white girl. And it's to his family, it's the same conflict. It's the same thing, that he's just doing this thing that's not in their path for him. And I think that's such a great, when you can, like, find in your own story what themes other people can pull from, I think is the best, like, foundation of, like, telling your own story. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. The other thing that, like, in rewatching it, just, like, every single, there's, like, every other rewatch after the first time, my first relationship, which was with a guy who was not white, whose parents ended up breaking us up because they didn't like me.
Really?
And so, yeah, so, like, I'm just, like, relating to
that
it
is, that that's pretty specific,
more.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, like, the, I, like, the, understand, like, the, in that fight scene that Emily and him are having, like, there's, she shows, like, the frustration with him, like, keeping that from her, and, but it, there's also, like, I think, and so they, in the interviews, they said that they didn't actually have that fight. Like, Emily and Kumail were, like, they were in a situation where they were leading up to that fight, but they didn't have it. And then she went into a coma. And when she came out of the coma, they kind of worked through everything. So, and which I think is honestly probably even more realistic, that they wouldn't have even had, you know, they would have been trying to ignore it.
Right.
But, like, just the frustration that she showed, and, like, not only having the frustration with him, because you're like, why would you lead me on almost, but also, like, you know, wanting to try to fight against it, like, being like, but we like each other, why is this, you know, why is this happening, this shouldn't be happening, like, it shouldn't be this hard, but then also just, like, having to face what it is, and, like, how she was like, I don't want to be the reason that your family doesn't talk to you anymore, or whatever, like, the guilt in and of itself, yeah. Of just, like being like, oh wow, yeah, I'm the problem, like,
yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I one of the things I think that I've started to try to learn more about since I first saw the movie is, like, you know, I knew Emily V. Gordon was Kumail's wife. Like, that's all I knew about her. And she's the co-writer on the movie with him. Like, they wrote it together. And as I've learned more about, like, what she wrote for, one thing that clicked with me a lot that made sense was that she wrote for the Carmichael show, Gerard Carmichael's sitcom. And did you ever watch that show? Any of it? I don't know if you're a fan of Gerard, or if you, like, know his stand-up, but like the show is similar to stand-up, but like the show is kind of infamous for the fact that like it had like a sitcom vibe, like it had a laugh track and it was like a sitcom, but it dealt with really heavy issues. Like there's like a whole episode where his parents think that their new Muslim neighbor is a terrorist, and like, which like stuff like that, that's very like, you know, heavy and like obviously like socially aware, but then also like, you know, acknowledging like the bigotry of your main characters and stuff like that. And it made a lot of sense for me when I realized like she's writing a movie here about her own coma. Like she's writing a movie about probably like the darkest, most difficult point in her life, and still enabled to like find the, you know, levity in that, but in a way that's so human, like not in a way that feels like we're ignoring what's sad or intense about the situation, but like using that intensity and feeling that into making a funny movie. I wanted to mention that, 'cause like I didn't know anything about her, I guess, before I saw this movie.
I definitely like finding out that she like fully co-wrote, like, and she talked about on like different platforms and stuff about how like when they started doing promo, they just wanted to talk to Kumail, and Kumail was like, we co-wrote it, like it's half and half, like you ask us both questions, you know. And and then like she she was like, she had I still follow her on like Twitter and Instagram and stuff, and like she basically like the whole coma happened because it turns out like she has chronic illness and she still faces that today. It's just like she's able to manage it and talking about that. So she like posts about that on Instagram and all this stuff. But like when it first came out, and like, you know, like I said, I never had a favorite movie before. So all the energy that anybody has ever used to love a movie surfaced in that moment. And so I was like, I would be like tweeting at her and stuff. And she's not as famous as Kumail, or like, no, she's probably more famous, but like at the time, and well, now Kumail's even more famous, but so she would actually like reply to me.
Oh, cool.
And like, you know, like
if you had some conversations.
Yeah, if I like tagged her and stuff, like there was one time I made my own t-shirt because they didn't have merch, and they still don't. They never sold merch for the movie, which I was upset about. And so I made my own shirt, and I was like, you guys gotta make, I just want to support you so bad, please make merch. And she was like, but how could we top this? And I was like, you're right, my shirt is that good. And then another time I posted a for Valentine's Day, I did like a makeup look or whatever, and like dressed up. I love dressing up for Valentine's Day. And then I was like holding The Big Sick, like my DVD. Oh, wow. And I was like, Valentine's Day is just like a big promotion for The Big Sick. That's all it is. And she quote tweeted it, and she was like, we should have put this on the billboards. And I was like, stop, Emily, stop. Are we about to kiss right now? So yeah, I definitely like I mean, obviously I love Kumail, and I always have, but like the movie, after the movie, I sought out more content from Emily. Like I gravitated towards Emily. I was like, this is so cool, and it's all about you. And I think they're equal parts, and I loved watching all her interviews and stuff. And I still follow her.
Yeah, I, so what you do, from what you do know about her, how well do you think Zoe Kazan, like, I guess, does justice to
her? Pretty well. And they talk about, like, there's some interviews with both of them and stuff, and like Emily talks about how much she loves like the way that she laughed, and like, you know, in the movie scene where he's like showing her that horror movie. And
yeah, the Night of the Living Dead, right? Or yes. No, it's when he's showing her the Vincent Price movie and he's staring at her the whole time.
Yeah. Watch. Yeah.
Yes.
Watch.
Yeah.
This part. Yeah. That's me every time I show a movie to Sungjin. I was doing it to him while we were rewatching it on Sunday. But yeah, she talked about like that scene in particular and like how she like yawns and then Kamal's like, "You're yawning." And she's like, "Sorry, it's just like something that happens when you're watching a really boring movie." And then like laughs. And she's like, literally like incredible. She's like, I'm so flattered to be played by you. Like, it's just, you do like such a good job of just being this really authentic person on screen. And yeah. Like, being lovable in a way that she's like, I could only hope to be.
I can tell you've watched the movie a lot of times because you just like, you perfectly got like the exact moment where she like pauses and like how she like the whole inflection of that sentence. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's something too, that it's like a great actor does something like that with a line. There's a million ways you could do that line, but it does come out in a way that's like, you feel everything. You feel that like, it's something that sounds like the way she says it, you're like, that's a line that she's saying to somebody that she loves and is saying it as a joke, but also might kind of mean it.
Like, yeah. Doesn't want to watch the movie. Like, I love that they gave her, like, even if Emily doesn't really have an edge, like I love that they gave her that little edge of like, how often does this like trick work? And then like, how many times have you shown a girl a B level horror movie?
Yeah.
And he's like, it's not a B level horror. Like, it's so good.
That's a huge success of the movie too, is that considering that the whole movie hinges on her being in a coma, like that's where the bulk of the movie happens, we still get to know her character so well in such a small amount of time, which gives the proper stakes to that relationship. Like, I feel like that's such a difficult thing to write for too, to be able to be like, okay, in the first act of the movie, we're gonna make you care so much about this relationship that even though she's going to be asleep for most of the movie, you're still going to care. And yeah, all of that they do such a good job with. The director of the movie, Michael Showalter, I knew from, I don't know if you've ever watched Wet Hot American Summer. That was my introduction to him. He used to be like, he's been like a comedy writer and was an actor for a long time. He has a history in rom-coms too. The first movie he ever directed, he also starred in, and it was called The Baxter. And it's about, it's basically about like the character in a rom-com that the main woman leaves to get with the guy, the mm-hmm. main guy with, but it's focused on that character, like kind mm-hmm. of is the joke of the movie. But he just recently, because he this past year, he directed a movie called The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and he was on a podcast to promote it called The Movies That Made Me. And it's like where they talk about, like, they'll have directors come talk about the movies that they loved growing up. And he is like a big rom-com guy, and he likes all kinds of movies, but he was specifically talking about, like, he was in like the movies of like a lot of these like city-based kind of more realistic rom-coms about like sometimes bad people. Like, he likes Woody Allen movies and stuff like that he was talking about. And like, this is a movie where it's like, it's very important that it takes place in Chicago, and it's like the city is a big part of it. And then also like I think like the best rom-coms, and kind of like I was saying before about why so many of them are poorly written, it's like the really good ones are the ones where the only thing standing between the main character and their happiness is themselves. And, and that's something like he does such a good job with. But also like, I think for a comedy, the movie has like, it's very like the visuals are like very, like, it's kind of muted. There's like handheld camera. It looks like a depressing movie if you're just looking at the images, you know?
It's tinted blue a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Like a murkier color palette. But that's something that works for it too. You're like, wow, the situation's really dire, but we're still getting, like, our humanity is still coming through it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that was going to be the most film school-y thing I was going to say in the whole episode, but I need to make sure I got that out. Is there anything else in your notes that you wanted to make sure we get to?
No, I think we covered all of it.
Okay. So one thing I want to point out, and I there's a, So I guess the most difficult thing to kind of talk about with this movie is I was looking up Half Star Letterboxd reviews for the movie. And I'll get to the funnier ones later. But the one thing that does come up a lot, like the, cause I, my, the, every time I'm talking about a movie that I love here and I look up the reviews, I'm always like, what could people possibly say that they don't like? And the one kind of accusation that keeps coming up that I thought was interesting was the accusation that the movie is, some have just kind of outright called it Islamophobic, which, you know, I'm like, that's just a very broad term. But then some people specifically talked about like its depiction of Muslim women, and that like through his mom and like the girls that he's dating, that they're all caricatures, but it's like, and he wants to get away and just date a white woman.
I see.
I don't know if this is like a thing that you ever thought of while watching. It definitely wasn't something that really, just since it's an autobiographical movie, I never thought of the movie as having like, you know, bad motives or anything. But one thing I kind of thought about was like, it reminded me though of that one scene that I think is a really key scene where one of the women that his mom is trying to pair him up with, he has that moment where then she's like, well, do you want to hang out again? And he's like, no, I don't really want to. And she just gets very upset. She's just like, I'm just tired of the whole thing, like the whole dating thing. And I think that's such a key scene in the movie to kind of deciphering it and trying to make sure that these women are not being caricatures, that she's still dealing with all the same dating bullshit.
Yeah. That everybody does. I mean, I think the criticism is valid, but yeah. I also think that like, given the time that they had in the movie, like that's what those scenes were. Like that's what they chose for those scenes to be. But then, like you said, like I think the inclusion of somebody, like, you know, that they had a second date basically. Yeah. Like, and then she's like, okay, so how are we feeling? You know, are we gonna go through with this? And like, yeah, for her to like, they did humanize her and like they showed like that she was cool. But and I feel like the mom. The mom is, I don't know, I have a goofy mom, that is just how my mom acts, so like that, like her being a little silly is like so real to me.
Yeah,
like being very silly and being very strict, exactly my mom. But yeah, I mean, I get it, but that, I think that is the choice that they made. They made it to be these little cutscenes because they made it to be a way that they could, you know, make it funny in between it.
Yeah, and you have
stuff going on,
and you have to somehow relate to his point of view of wanting to get out of this and not wanting an arranged marriage and not wanting, you know, his family's traditions. Another moment that I do like in terms of his mom, maybe my favorite scene in the movie is the last scene with his dad when he's about to move to New York, and you know, the car pulls up, and you know, his mom's still in the car, and his dad is like, you know, you're still banned from the family. Like, he starts off with that. And then, like, you know, but, like, gives him some food and then says, like, and, you know, your mother made this. Also, we want you to call us when you get there.
Yeah.
And then he also has that great moment where he asks him, because he knows that his parents had this arranged marriage, so he's always had this idea that they don't love each other the way that maybe that people who date a tradition, like, the normal, quote-unquote normal way would. But then when like he asks his dad what movie they saw, and his dad does remember the movie, like, I think that's such a key moment because it is telling him that like his parents still, they still have a romance. Like, they still love each other, that, you know, there's nothing inhuman about like about the way that their relationship is now. And then also that, you know, despite all of the tradition, despite them being such a traditional family, his mom's still a mother and she still cares about him and still wants to give him the, you know, yeah, food for the road. And I think that's another really key scene in terms of like humanizing his parents and particularly his mom, or even his mom, who's going to be the strictest person about these rules, still, like any human mother, cares about her son, and ultimately that means more to her.
Yeah. And I think like kind of what you said is just that, like, at the end of the day, those scenes were more so portraying why Kumail doesn't fit into this culture, because he's right, removed himself from, like, he's not open to the idea, he's not trying. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Whereas when he talks to his brother, he has that scene where his brother talks about like, yeah, it was awkward at first, but she Kumi, she's my best friend now. Like,
yeah.
And like, you know, yeah, the loving relationship between his parents, and then also like how much Navid and his wife get along, like show that, yeah, they're like the two relationships that you do see, like Muslim arranged marriage relationships that you do see, are very happy and good. So yeah. Like, while they do kind of portray it as like this like ridiculous thing that you could be doing, at the same time they show that it does indeed work for some people. It's just not going to work for Kamel.
Right. Yeah. It's a very individual situation. And yeah, that's a really good point. One other thing I wanted to ask, I don't know if you found this out, but like in kind of your research, from having seen The Bigger Sick and everything and knowing more about the true story, do you know how true it is, the one man show that he puts on in the movie?
I don't know. I thought about that too. I'm like, I wonder if that's something that he really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know that they've, I feel like if they would have talked about it, I probably would have remembered, and I don't remember them saying anything about it.
Yeah, it is really great for his arc too, and the way that he, you know, for a long time, the one man show is him just like talking about Pakistan and history, and he's seeing it from a very like removed perspective, and by the end of it, he's accepted it as a part of his identity, and so now the show is more about him.
Yeah.
Which also, like, in terms of comedy, that's like, if you're a comic, that's a huge part of like an arc that a lot of us have to have, is like, at what point are you going to stop only writing bits about like ketchup packets or something, and like, and start like, and not necessarily that this is that for everybody, that the great thing about comedy is like, you can literally talk about anything. It doesn't have to be about yourself, but to become vulnerable in that way on stage. Like, was that something you related to, that kind of like slowly trying to like open yourself up more and like integrate more of your identity into your act as well?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's like a super scary thing to do. And I think a lot of people start out as like making the joke about the surface level things that the audience can tell from about them, mm-hmm. like whatever that aspect of your identity it might be. And so like, just in like Kumail's like one man show, he goes from like just talking about where he's from, talking about like, you know, like his race or his religion, and then going to further down the line and being like, oh, okay, here I am that person. We've already established this is who I am, and now let's actually talk about like an aspect of that. And I think that's like a huge difference that you can see in more experienced comedy, like comedians in general. I obviously notice it mostly with queer comics, and in myself too, about how I write about being queer. Some like rules that I made for myself is I don't make fun of being queer. I don't put myself down. I don't put other people down. I'm always who I am, and then here's my content. So like, to go from like making like my older stuff, like making little puns or jokes about like my labels or whatever it is, to now like one of my main bits is talking about a queer experience matter-of-factly, you know, like I talk about my best friend, his hysterectomy. I talk about his hysterectomy and like in the most fun and playful way, where like if you're not paying attention, you might not realize like what that means for him, or like what the reality of that situation was. Like, right. I'm just busy on like telling you the jokes that I told the surgeon when they were there, kind of thing. So it's like being able to write about that sort of stuff in a way that almost, not only does it like make the audience solidify who you are, like you're not propositioning it to them. Like, it's not, they can agree with it or they can't. Like, this is it. Here, I've already, like, this is established, this is here, now I'm making the joke about it, and I feel like I've seen like a big difference in like who I can get to laugh about a queer experience, maybe without even knowing it, or like without, I don't give them the opportunity to be like, am I gonna agree with this or not, like
right, yeah,
no, here we fucking go, like. And especially doing comedy in Michigan, you know, yes. Depending on the room.
Yeah,
it's a good motto to have.
What do you notice about that, about people's reaction? Do you feel like more often than not people are like, all right, I'm on board, or do you see a lot of resistance in general, or is it just really like across the board, like it's totally different depending on the crowd?
It definitely depends on the crowd. There are times where if I'm, because I got the double whammy, I'm talking about being trans, I'm talking about being gay, and I'm talking about being autistic, like these are all things people love to hate you for, like just love to make fun of you, love to kick you around about. And there are times where, because I'm so confident in who I am, and people are like, no, you're not, you can't be, that's not that, it's more of laughing at me than with me, you know, like I'm so ready to just like, let's laugh about this, you know, let's like, I'm gonna make a joke about this. And like sometimes I can definitely feel the energy is like, oh, ha 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 ha, like, you know, like, yeah. Sure you did, or like, oh, haha. And more like less than like, oh, I appreciate the comedy in that. But like, I do think that that comes from, I get the reaction from like conservative crowds and liberal crowds. Like there are people that'll say that they're accepting, but when I go to talk about the nitty gritty about it, they're like, oh, ha, 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 no, you're not like a real person. And then like, even like more conservative crowds where they're like, all right, I don't agree with this, but that was funny. I do appreciate the craft.
right.
So it's just like a matter of like, you know, respect at the end of the day. And whether they respect you or not, you could still probably get them to laugh.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Oddly enough, I think sometimes I find that every now and then a conservative crowd is a little easier, where it's like, even if they might disagree with what I'm saying, I think conservatives think less about what they're laughing at. They just laugh, like it's just their guttural reaction to whatever's funny. And I do think liberal crowds, particularly like center left crowds, they think a lot about what they're laughing at, and they're thinking about their laughing as a performance in of itself. And so sometimes it's a little trickier. It's a little more, you have to get them still, that place of it's okay, you can laugh.
They still have the idea that anything you laugh about, you're laughing at. Like, right. They're like, oh, I can't do that because I'm laughing at it. It's like, no, that comedian is making that joke. They're already in on it. Like,
right.
they said it on purpose, I promise you. Like,
yeah.
I will say though, like with like an Ann Arbor crowd, I don't trust them. Like they will pander. They will.
Sure.
They will be like, oh, you're so brave. Let me laugh. Right. And they're probably the audiences I get the most of. Like they come up to me after the show, and if I don't mention being trans, obviously, but like they come up after the show and they're like, it's just so nice to see a woman doing comedy. And it's like, you didn't even say if I was good. They're just like, so nice to see you up there.
Right.
You're being really brave.
Right.
It's like, okay.
They're like, I need you above all else to think that I'm a good person as an audience member.
Listen, I'm going to keep coming now. And it's like, okay, did you like the joke or did you not? Did you even laugh? I don't even know.
What was your favorite joke? Like, what?
Tell me right now.
I've said before, like I started writing jokes a couple years ago, like specifically about like when I lived in Mississippi and kind of like the most racially tense interactions I've had. And people will get dicey about that when you're talking about like, when we're talking about like times people have been, you know, like objectively racist to me. And I want to tell them, I'm like, guys, the fact that I'm telling you means I want you to laugh at it. Like it's,
yeah.
It's like, I'm not expecting you to groan or say, aw. Like, in fact, if you don't laugh at me, maybe you're racist. Maybe you're, but
you know, the one thing, just like heavy topics that are hard for people to laugh about. Like I've been trying to cope recently. I am coping and trying to make jokes about not only being assaulted, but being assaulted at a comedy show, and then telling people at a comedy show that I was assaulted at comedy shows. They don't want to.
That is the most impossible thing to remove yourself from as an audience member, because that's where
here?
We are now.
No.
Right.
Like yesterday, I was like, I prefaced it because I was like, I don't have this well written enough for me to not need to preface it yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I do need to preface this because my writing isn't good enough on it. But I was like, guys, like I'm kind of okay. Like, let's just get into it. And I was like, So if you know me from stand-up, you know that I was assaulted at two different comedy shows. And do you want to know the most fucked up part? Is that the only place I can go and be sure not to see them is the place that it happened. And then I just start laughing, and then the other people, in the, like the other comics in the crowd, are like, like, we're in pain right now, aren't we? I'm like, right. It is fucked up, isn't it? I am unwell.
Right.
But, and then my other punchline is the one I'm trying to get, because I just think it's a funny phrase, is trying to get them to laugh at me saying, I wish I would have gotten assaulted at the dentist. Because I already don't like going to the dentist.
Right.
It's not my like favorite hobby. I like don't even brush my teeth. Like I don't like going to the dentist. I wish it would have happened there, not somewhere that I love and I want to continue to do all the time.
Right.
But yeah. Again, that's a fun line.
Yeah. But... and that's an objectively like that's like a funny angle to have on it for sure.
Thank you.
I pulled up some half star reviews that I thought were kind of goofy. One of which person didn't even watch the movie. They gave it a half a star out of five and just wrote, not going to watch this for obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons?
Like, call me crazy. I don't know what the obvious reasons are.
I hate brown people.
I hate brown people. Or I hate stand-up comedians. I don't know. Really.
Which one is it?
This one
I... put them together.
I like okay, this one, tomatoes boo, throwing tomatoes. The symbolism of presenting this white love interest with a jar of brown women's pictures ashes, whoa, that's the only criticism. I'm like, all right, yeah, that was a bit weird.
I mean, he says in the thing, he's like, this is a bad idea,
right? He acknowledges, like, that's, yeah,
it's just like when people criticize like that, I'm like, you know, Kamal wrote this, right? I'm, yeah. Like, it's not like it was like against his will.
That was one person in the review. I think they just didn't look at the credits. They were like, why did Kumail decide to do this? Or like, it was like, why did Kumail agree to this?
I know, this.
Yeah, you mean the movie that he wrote?
You mean the movie about his life?
Yeah. This is my favorite review. This is the last one. Half star out of five. Culture clash. Arg. OMG. Bazinga. How will Kumail survive? Cry, cry, cry. Puke. That's it. So that was
they
a nice
got him there. Note to end it on.
Yeah, I like the use of Bazinga in there, kind of accusing the movie of being like I guess Big Bang Theory-esque. I don't quite see it, but
yeah, I
it's
guess.
Much better.
Yeah, I think Big Bang Theory is
sucks
hard.
yeah, no, it's bad. I that's the hill I'm willing to die on this podcast.
There's one thing I want everybody to know.
The Big Bang Theory is very bad.
Sucks ass.
Yeah. So thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad I had a reason to rewatch this movie too for this. It's also a movie that I really love. And I'm it's so cool that it gave you a favorite movie.
I'm so glad. I hope a better movie never comes out.
You're also going to be awkward after how hard you've gone on this one.
Yeah, I hope this is it. Something's wrong because my mind is fading. And
everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting. All right, everybody, that wraps up yet another episode of We Are Movies. Thank you so much for listening. Huge thank you to Diana for coming on. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun talking about this movie. Definitely go follow them on all the social media stuff. They're on TikTok at Diana G. Graham and on Instagram at Diana.Graham. Very funny, as I said. And also, if you're a fan of this podcast and you haven't yet, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at We Are Movies Pod. You can also like the Facebook page We Are Movies. Also follow me on Letterboxd at Johnny Mockney, JohnnyMocny. That's all I have for you today. I'll be back with you very soon. And until then, talk to somebody about 9/11.